Okay, so this guy reached up and apparently just read the right label and pulled the wrong chain or something like
Correct.
That. Okay, yeah.
All right, then the problem comes up of finding out where are they. Since they can be mixed. They wouldn't just necessarily be in any one terminal.
The traceability was a problem.
So the traceability becomes a problem, and you have to also alert everybody else. It's part of the government system that if you run across a problem of any kind of material or any contractor goof, or I guess you would say not only contract, any goof, it could be a government supply itself, but if there's a goof that's a human error or a materials area or something like this, you send out an alert so that everybody else knows that, hey, there's something wrong or possibly wrong, so that they can also look into it or wait for you to find out what it is if they don't have to use it right then, and then they can go in and take the corrective measures. So we have that kind of working relationship. They do the same for us. So this alert goes out, and what we had to do was figure out some way to find them without disassembling every missile. The way we did, somebody had come up, and I was trying to think of who it was. It was out of Union Carbide, which I guess Haynes must be a subdivision.
I think Haynes subdivision.
They were so concerned about this because it obviously was their goof that they contacted some of their other divisions for help. And someone out of Oak Ridge had developed a eddy current method
that
allowed them to tell the difference. And he said, if I can get a probe against the material, I can tell you whether or not it is stainless steel or Haynes stellite. They have different characteristics. He said, at least I can tell you in most cases, he said, there may be a few who will not. So, of course, we don't know this to be a fact, so he's got to demonstrate that. So what he did, he gets some of each, he demonstrates that they try different batches, and they find out the range. And you get two curves that look like two bell-shaped curves, and they overlap in one little area, but they're distributed such that all of the stellites in one and all the others in the other, except for one little overlap area. So that says that you've got a pretty good confidence that you can get rid of some of them without any question. You say, definitely it isn't. There's no possibility it's either this material or the other. The other ones, there was a range of values that said, hey, if it's in there and we can't say for sure, so you have no choice but to go on down there and run some other kind of test. You know, I mean, that means you have to physically get it out the way you can see
it.
But that meant that he had to, first he had to have that technique, which the guy had to develop. The second thing he had to do was he had to develop a probe that would be able to get in through the accesses that were available without disassembly and get it against the blades. And what they actually did, now unfortunately I don't have an H1 model, but that's a J2 there.
Yeah.
But, they took off the solid propellant spinner motor that turns the turbine, and you could go up through that opening and snake around to where you could touch the blades, and you could get the reading, and then you crank the thing over to the next place, and they took readings around, I think it was five places around the periphery of the thing, which would give them the possibility of detecting all of the blades in the thing. It was quite an elaborate process.
So they were able to detect each blade in the thing?
Yeah, by putting the pack probe he had, it would cover, you know, a few blades in the tree, and they could tell what they had by doing it.
But this meant they had to go back and check the H1, but then I would guess the S3D engines that were...
Any of the elements that had bought from there had to also be checked. And I'm not sure now, since we did not, you know, that was not part of our activity, but we did alert everybody.
Yeah.
I'm sure that they must have done the same thing.
Okay, well, again, that closes up the question, because I was never sure what happened.
But they were at least able to isolate the batch of the bad steel, of the wrong type of steel.
You could isolate it, but you couldn't be totally sure.
No, that's true.
That there had been another mistake somewhere in there. So you could get that purchase order down and isolate it. But how many times in the past might the same mistake have been made? So what we did, of course, is have them change the location of the bins, for one thing, so that materials that looked somewhat alike could not be next to each other. So that by actually seeing it, the guy would instantly know it was the wrong thing if he pulled the wrong chain. constituents. And I don't know of any other precautions other than that. That costs quite a bit of money.
I can't forget.
Wow.
And quite an effort.
It was
a lot
quite
of time
a bad,
involved,
a
yeah.
bad thing. That's why Union Carbide, as a parent corporation, took a real, I think, a very admirable and concerted effort on their part, because they realized it was their goof. But you know, you could say, some companies would say, "Oh, well, so what?" But
yeah.
they took a real interest, and they looked all through their broader spectrum and found somebody who happened to have the right information. It was, we were fortunate, I guess, that it was available. But I don't know what else you could have done except disassemble the mountain.
A while ago, when we were talking about combustion instability, you mentioned flame front. I mean, I need to come back to that. I mean, I'm not quite sure what the significance of the flame front is, and what you know about the distance of it, or
well,
so
if you're too close to the, if you're burning too close to, you want to burn fairly close to the injector, but if you're burning too close to it, you overheat the injector, and
okay.
then it
yeah.
warps the plates.
Right.
And then it, so in some injectors, in some of the ones with the higher temperatures, we actually have poured metal, like in the hydrogen ones, so that you can get a cooling through that way. But in the early ones, we had a plate with a plate behind it, and in between is flowing the LOX in before it goes into the openings, you see. And so it's cooling it by the actual flow passages of the LOX and the kerosene.
Now, how far would the flame front be? We're talking about a 1/16 of an inch or 2 inches or
I would prefer not to answer that because we'd better get one of our technical experts on the thing. I don't know. Those things varied all over the place during the development. I'm not sure when.
But it wouldn't be more than a foot or something.
Oh,
like
no,
that.
No, no, no. We're talking fractions of an inch.
Okay, fractions
yeah.
of an inch.
Yeah.
Okay, that's what
yeah.
I was just getting at.
Yeah, it's not a long way.
Not
back,
even a 2-inch.
No, you would be closer.
All right. Well,
I think one bit of humor here, if you will, on this combustion stability. Let me remember this. So on every engine, we had what they call, we developed an engine model specification. We were talking about this the other day, you know. But and one thing that we forced upon our contractor was the fact that
don't use any names.
I won't. Okay. We forced upon our contractor is the fact that as a part of our F1 engine model spec, for example, we had a statement that engine malfunction or rough combustion would produce little or no damage to the Saturn V vehicle, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, Rocketdyne was kind of quite worried because of the fact that what happens if this thing blows up over a major populated area or something like that, you know, is he then going to be responsible for the whole Saturn V vehicle, you know. Well, it was at that time, remember, we found out that the Lloyd's of London, you know, even though sometimes they make the claim of Van Schier, everything does not really impact this year, everything, because Rocketdyne, before they bought this particular thing, you know, into model spec, gone to Lloyd's in London and to try to insure themselves against a loss of a Saturn V vehicle, and they were turned down.
And Lloyd's wouldn't do it?
No, at $1 billion a vehicle, they turned it down, I guess, you know. And
I'd never heard that one before.
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, it is. I think there's a bit of humor. That's rather funny, but we were told
yeah.
this during the negotiation of the engine model spec when we tried to force this down the contractor's throat, because in other words, we said, look, this thing, if it malfunctions or runs rough, got to produce either little or no damage to the vehicle, so you know. So at that time, they thought to themselves, gee whiz, if that's the case, and they're stuck with it. So with a Saturn V vehicle, they better insure themselves, you know.
Yeah.
I thought it was rather humorous, you know.
So whatever happened
yeah.
to the spec, did you find that they
well,
found
no,
they,
it? Well, no, they finally bought the spec, knowing, of course, that the government is
I thought
it's only insured, you know.
About the,
about
the
technical man of the thing, yeah. But it's,
I tell you the definition while we
what's that?
The definition of low enough.
Yeah, well, one thing about it, this, we had a room full of lawyers, I won't mention any names, you know, but the lawyers are trying to define what is really meant in this case by little or no damage, you know. And when the technical man steps up, he says, well, he says, in this case, he says, no means a little, and a little means a lot. He says, you know. Of course, that just broke up the meeting.
Yeah.
But
lawyers,
yeah.
that's not
the lawyers couldn't
plan.
Define
no.
little enough, but the technical man, he jumps up like a bull in a china closet and says, in this case, no means a little, and a little means a lot.
That's why
so,
you don't have technical men sometimes doing this.
Yeah, that was one humorous, I think, part of the history in the development of the engine. The fact that the engine did run rough and the Saturn V vehicle blew up, could Rocketdyne, in fact, be held responsible for the whole vehicle? And they found out that there wasn't an insurance company in the world that would tackle it. They went directly to Lloyd's of London and then it was turned down. They had no desire to insure against the loss of the Saturn V vehicle.
But that spec was still within the
it eventually ended up.
I think the reason that it did is. As these negotiations were going on, they began to have a little confidence in their product, too. We didn't have to sell it that day. Like these negotiations sometimes take a
what was funny at the time was the fact that at that time, they were known as North American Aviation Company. And during the negotiation, we were really trying to get this thing to the end of the model spec. Their project manager stood up and said, well, okay, if we buy this thing, he says, if one of them blows up, he says, we just turn the keys of the plant over to the government. He says, you know, I mean, they're bankrupt. He says, overnight, you know. It's a large corporation. That's right. Yeah. In other words, you suffer $1 million loss overnight, you take over the company, the government. There's nothing for any of you. That's what it really amounts to.
I think the reason we kind of want to mention this is to get a feel for the risk that some of the people have to take.
Right.
Yeah. Somebody had to make that decision within the company that yes, they will go along, and the government had to insist on something to protect the thing because we were liable to all the other people in the stack because the engines were all furnished by the government to the other contractors. So
yeah.
If they didn't work, then you're liable for everything that they have on the way of loss. And we also had incentives on each of the other contractors as well as on the engine contractor for performance. So what do you do if the engine causes the stage to fail? Does stage man still get his incentive for a perfect flight. So that's your problem.
Takes a lot of
so those kind of things made it very necessary to have in such statements as we were talking about here to be sure that the contractors understood that they had a pretty good stake in the thing.
I remember talking to a guy named Lloyd Sawyer, who was Donald Douglas, and he had been involved in this kind of thing. He started giving me some of the parameters, and
mm-hmm.
it was just like a Pandora's box.
Yeah.
Almost. There's another aspect of the F1 I wanted to try and nail down a little bit, and this is furnace brazing of the engine, which apparently began in 1965,
okay.
as I recall, or that's the date I came up with
somewhere. Yeah, I think it's pretty close.
But now then, how was the brazing done before 1965, and how would you explain the production then of the RL-10 and the H1 and the J2? Did they use furnace brazing, or were they hand brazed, or what? How did they do it before furnace brazing on the F1?
Well, the RL-10, as far as I'm aware, I was present manager at the plant during the development. We always used the furnace brazing.
Oh, RL? They always had a furnace brazing
for RL-10.
For on RL-10.
Yeah. Now, we had some hand brazing repair.
Yeah.
But always had furnace brazing for the engine.
Of course, there's a big difference in size.
Different. And the size and the difference in the material.
Yeah.
Now the H1, as I recall, was hand brazed up until they had the problem with sulfur embrittlement. The sulfur embrittlement came about with the nickel alloy tubes that they had were subject to embrittlement from the sulfur and the kerosene after repeated burn.
Mm-hmm.
And we found out that on some of the test engines after a while, and this was, you know, after a good while into the program, found out that some of the tubes started splitting.
Okay.
With the tube splitting on the early engines, they had to look then at what could they do to correct it. You can't purify the kerosene. Well, you could, I guess, purify it without it to have gotten rid of the sulfur, but that didn't seem to be a practical approach because one of the reasons you were using it so that you have it readily available from any of several manufacturers. We did make a study of which ones had the most sulfur, which batches, why were you having it in this test stand and not in the one here, for example, or vice versa?
Hmm.
And it was traced to different batches of fuel bought from different contractors. Now, the spec was such that they were well within spec, but some had a little more sulfur than the others. So then you trace it down and find out that's really what's caused it. Okay, we go to the next step. Knowing that stainless steel was being used by RL-10 for the hydrogen, I imagine J2 started off with stainless steel in the beginning also. And I'm not sure, when did the J2 contract start? You remember that?
We had a letter contract on J2 about 1960.
Okay, so they probably were already into stainless steel there. So
yeah.
it was natural then for them to look into that area. Could they use that? With the stainless steel, it was possible then to do the furnace brazing. I'm not sure that you could have done furnace brazing with the nickel. I don't recall anybody trying it. I'm not a metallurgist, so I'm not sure whether you could or couldn't, but I know that when they knew they had to make the change to stainless steel, it made sense to make the change to furnace brazing.
Okay, now that really helps clear up a problem that I had in trying to cope with. And the furnace brazing, as I understood from reading the descriptions of it, really was a big breakthrough in terms of production.
Reduces the time and gets a much better
seal.
It's It's a little hard to do. Again, it's a state-of-the-art type thing. You've got to get the right amount of braised material in the right location, the temperature right. You've got to have the airflow such that it doesn't blow back the melted braise out of the void, you know, leave voids in the space between the tubes. The stacking and the spacing of the tubes is quite critical. The cleanliness of the tubes is quite critical. Things of this sort. But once you've got that down, the furnace brazing is far superior to the template.
Did they use furnace brazing on the H1, or how are H1 engines or F3 engines produced?
The early H1s were hand brazed. And the furnace brazing on the H1 came about with the tube split.
Okay, so they about at the same time.
Yeah, at the time the tube was split.
Tube splitting showed up first. Tube splitting showed up first on the H1.
Okay,
And the time frame there, what you said, 65, I don't recall, that's why I'm hesitating. I don't recall whether the F1 started out hand brazed or not, but I think they were hand brazed to begin with.
Well, that's the impression I had. You know,
I think the first R&D engines were probably hand brazed.
I'm almost positive there were for two reasons that I think of right off the bat. One of them is that they didn't know that they had the problem, and it's probably wasn't a development made of a method for doing it on the nickel type tubes.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one is, I would think, would be the size of it, would be the furnace for that size would probably be something they would not have had to go into unless they had to.
Yeah,
it was a very special facility.
Yeah,
because of the
right,
size,
right.
Thing.
Yeah, the large. But I know that the tube splitting on the H1 made it necessary to go back and on the H1 we had to change and across the board.
Okay.
Had to go back and ask for more money.
Okay, well, what was it? Sulfur, you said? In the
Sulfur.
That gets me, too, about even aviation fuels. Apparently, back in the early days, that's what really sparked my memory here, is that some aviation fuels perform better depending on which part of the country the refinery was located.
Uh-huh. Well,
and this variation in fuel just strikes me again. It's really a...
The surprising thing,
yeah,
if you look at the specifications are fairly tight.
Yeah.
And yet, minute differences between the locations will... Maybe all of them will be within the spec, but the combinations will be in different ratios.
When you always get into an operational phase, it seems to me a lot of parameters start changing real fast.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, I want to ask a question about the thrust chamber extension on the F1. Why it wasn't used on the H1 and the J2? And one special problem, was there a reignition in the thrust chamber extension area using the fuel-rich gas generator exhaust? Is that, or am I totally confused on that?
You got more than one question here.
Yeah.
The first question was why we had the extension on the F1 and didn't have it on the H and the J.
Yeah.
I know why you had on F1, the size, and the difficulty of making things. It didn't make sense to make the lower part of it where you got that much expansion. Once you get to that point, there were other methods of being able to cool it without having the coolant flow through the tubes. It's not practical.
Okay.
So they had, what do we call those things, shingles, but...
That's the term I always came to use, or had seen, just shingles.
Yeah, I don't know if they had any other name. Anyway, they had a way of handling the cooling of it without having to use the tube, which it just wasn't practical for the size to do that. Now, on the H and J, I would assume the reason it was never considered, they were well within the size it could be handled with the standard tube cooling format.
Okay, so...
And I would think that also the tube cooling format is better in that you don't have to replace, for the other, if you want to reuse it as we did for testing, you have to repair those shingles, replace the shingles on it. But one launch type thing, you wouldn't have a problem. But I think it was the size.
Okay, the other thing that I was never clear about is that somewhere I got the idea that there was a reignition phase of some kind in the thrust chamber extension area, and that this was the fuel-rich gas generator exhaust.
You took the exhaust from the gas generator.
Yeah.
They went down into an exhaust aerator and were fed back in to the chamber down right, I wish we had a model. right down, if you've seen the F1 engine picture, you see that big round bulge at the bottom?
Right.
The
we call it a horse collar sometimes.
No, down below that.
Oh, down below the horse collar, okay.
The gas generator comes, exhaust, which is fuel rich, goes in and it's fed back in there, and it gets thrown into the hot gas stream there, and it's burning. Some additional burning and thrust anyway, you would have thrust anyway from that, rather than have it exhausted in a way that would cause you a disturbance in, as far as, if you took the gas generator for example, the output of it is about as much as you have off of, say, an H1 engine.
Yeah.
So you would have a disturbance that would be hard to control from a control point of view, so you want it all to come out at the same place on the gimbal of where it was within the gimbal capability of the F1 engine.
Right.
So as far as having a second ignition, I don't recall. I think it's burning, and it would be some more burning probably take place because.
Okay, that was it because it comes in fuel ratio and
right.
It hits those high temperatures. So
that's right.
There was no additional ignition.
Okay,
but the real reason for putting it in there is I would think, and from my knowledge of the vehicle, would be the control problem. If you had that exhausting, that much thrust exhausting somewhere else, you would have to then worry about it as a. Offload thrust. That's a fair amount of thrust comes out in general.
That's
up to
60,000 horsepower, as I recall.
65,000 horsepower turbo pump.
Yeah, turbo pump, yeah.
Right. See, the gas generator for that was it was as large as many of the engines we used earlier for the whole
system. You figure that, for example, on the F1 now, that turbo pump, 65,000 horsepower, was actually pumping 3 tons of fuel every second. Yeah, 2 tons of liquid oxygen and 1 ton of RP fuel a second. You know, so that's a lot of fuel.
That's putting it out.
Right.
Okay. There's another question I had here on uprating. The engines were all uprated one time or another,
mm-hmm.
And I guess each of the engines, H1, J2, and F1, all went through uprating.
RL10 also.
RL10. So how do you uprate an engine? Are there general things, or were there specific things for each engine? Take the F1, for example.
There are several things that are done, but you need to also know the reasons.
Yeah.
The reasons they're usually done is because as you get further into the development of the missile and its payload, package, you find out that the payload and the weight of the missile historically grow more than the optimistic estimates of what they can do. Then the engine is called on to make up the difference quite frequently. Now, not in all cases. In some of the stages, they were quite successful in going back and chemical milling of surfaces to reduce excess weight and all that to make a good portion of the savings themselves. But in all cases, the engines had to be uprated in order to take care of the payload. Give enough margin. So that's one reason. The second thing, part of the question you ask, how is it done? One of the ones you do is you can up the thrust if the vehicle can take it, and that's a matter of growth that's built into the thing to start with. You want to have take the million he mentioned first. If you took a 1,000,000 pound thrust engine, you would probably design it at 1,000,002 or something like that. Be sure that you'd get your 1,000,000.
Okay.
Right.
Now, you couldn't guarantee that you could deliver 1,000,002 because some of them would be somewhere between the 1,000,000 and the 1,000,002. So to uprate it, you then increase the flow rates, you do some other things to change the characteristics of the burning, and you get more thrust out. The thrust is usually the shape of the valve itself and the expansion ratio, you know, the thrust is related to that and the temperature. But the additional performance you can get out of it by changing the specific impulse. That's another way for uprating. That's usually done by getting a better mixing of things so that you get a higher percentage of the fuel burned at the proper place in the cycle, so that you don't burn it all at the wrong point, so you get the full expansion all the way down. And that gets back to the patterns that are at the flame front, the good mixing characteristics.
So interesting. So the engines are normally planned and built with this.
Yeah,
you usually have to in order to be able to guarantee that you can deliver a certain. You usually have two parameters you have to guarantee. You have to guarantee a thrust, and you have to guarantee an isobaric, which is the impulse you're going to get for a certain amount of input of pounds, per pound. You have to say
1 pound of thrust per second per pound, something like that. Yeah.
You got to be able to guarantee that kind of combination so that the stage knows what it's going to have to. In order to its sizing and its flow rates and everything. All right, usually in both cases,
manufacturer will have to keep some margin, so he will have to build it to where it will demonstrate a little more than that. Well, as you get more confidence, you then begin to creep into this cushion and find out where is the real upper limit of the thing. You may find out that with a few minor adjustments here and there, it becomes possible. Good. Now, give it a good again to creep into this cushion. Change there that was a significant increase. And what we did was took at the throat, where we aired it down, it was necked down, bent to a different shape. Mm. It was a very severe neck bend. Okay, then the ratio of that opening to the old opening of the bell has changed, so you got a fantastic increase in the expansion ratio, which gives you a fairly significant change.
In time.
Right.
Yeah.
But see, you can't do that. The bell has changes. You can make changes in the contour to do it if it's within the capabilities of the system to do. Some work the other way.
Yeah, just really get a myriad of trade offs.
One, for example, when we want to remain pound thrust, what they just call a booster engine without identification of the vehicle.
Yeah.
And finally ended up with 1.5 million. It meant identification of the vehicle and the turbo pump and one identification of the turbo pump and the redesign thing.
Yeah, you have to have more. You have to have more to push through at a different rate.
Beef up 5 million.
Stand a little more pressure, a little more flow rate. Things.
It depends on how much you really
have to push.
Beef up all your heart.
You have more to push. You can't do it without putting it straight. You have to put in sometimes special castings that would be beefed up. You have to put in a certain way. In some cases, you have to put flow casting out of position, things this sort. So that when it gets structural change, it doesn't position, things this sort. You can't do it on all cases. He can demonstrate. Planning to be just for example, center with the center phase.